Part 2. Chapter 1. At the Goodson Airport, in one of the gilt-framed mirrors of its old-fashioned waiting room, Vaughn glimpsed the silk hat of his father, who sat awaiting him in an armchair of imitation marble wood behind a newspaper that said in reversed characters, "Crimea capitulates." At the same moment, a raincoated man with a pleasant, somewhat porcine pink face accosted Vaughn. He represented a famous international agency known as the VPL, which handled very private letters. After a first flash of surprise, Vaughn reflected that Ada Veen, a recent mistress of his, could not have chosen a smarter, in all senses of the word, way of conveying to him a message whose fantastically priced and prized process of transmission ensured an absoluteness of secrecy which neither torture nor mesmerism had been able to break down in the evil days of 1859. It was rumored that even Gamaliel, on his no longer frequent, alas, trips to Paris, and King Victor, during his still fairly regular visits to Cuba or Hecuba, and, of course, robust Lord Gowell, Viceroy of France, when enjoying his randonnées all over Canada, preferred the phenomenally discreet and, in fact, rather creepy infallibility of the VPL organization to such official facilities as sexually starved potentates have at their disposal for deceiving their wives. The present messenger called himself James Jones, a formula whose complete lack of connotation made an ideal pseudonym, despite its happening to be his real name. A flurry and flapping had started in the mirror, but Vaughn declined to act hastily. In order to gain time, for on being shown Ada's crest on a separate card, he felt he had to decide whether or not to accept her letter. He closely examined the badge, resembling an ace of hearts, which J.J. displayed with pardonable pride. He requested Vaughn to open the letter, satisfy himself of its authenticity, and sign the card that then went back into some secret pit or pouch within the young detective's attire or anatomy. Cries of welcome and impatience from Vaughn's father, wearing for the flight to France a scarlet silk-lined black cape, finally caused Vaughn to interrupt his colloquy with James and pocket the letter, which he read a few minutes later in the lavatory before boarding the airliner.
"Stocks," said Damon, "are on the zoom. Our territorial triumphs, etc. An American governor, my friend Besborodko, is to be installed in Bessarabia, and a British one, Armborough, will rule Armenia. I saw you enlaced with your little countess near the parking lot. If you marry her, I will disinherit you. They're quite a notch below our set."
"In a couple of years," said Vaughn, "I'll slide into my own little millions," meaning the fortune Aqua had left him.
"But you needn't worry, sir. We have interrupted our affair for the time being, till the next time I return to live in her guirlinière,"
Kennedy slang. Damon, flaunting his flair, desired to be told if Vaughn or his pool had gotten into trouble with the police, nodding toward Jim or John, who, having some other delivery to make, sat glancing through "Crime Copulate Bessarmenia." "Pool," replied Vaughn, with the evasive taciturnity of the Roman rabbi shielding Barabbas.
"Why gray?"
asked Damon, alluding to Vaughn's overcoat.
"Why that military cut? It's too late to enlist."
"I couldn't. My draft board would turn me down anyway."
"How's the wound?"
"Comme ci, comme ça." "It now appears that the Kalaganu surgeon messed up his job. The rip seam has grown red and raw, without any reason. And there's a lump in my armpit. I'm in for another spell of surgery, this time in London, where butchers carve so much better.
Where's the mestechko here?"
"Oh, I see it."
"Cute.
A gentian painted on one door, a lady fern on the other. Have to go to the herbarium." He did not answer her letter. And a fortnight later, John James, now got up as a German tourist, all pseudo-tweed checks, handed Vaughn a second message in the Louvre, right in front of Bosch's Bateau Ivre, the one with a jester drinking in the riggings. Poor old Dan thought it had something to do with Brandt's satirical poem. There would be no answer, though answers were included with the return ticket in the price, as the honest messenger pointed out. It was snowing. Yet James, in a fit of abstract rakishness, stood fanning himself with a third letter at the front door of Van's Cote Journée on Ronta River near Chos, and Van asked him to stop bringing him messages. In the course of the next 2 years, two more letters were handed to him, both in London, and both in the hall of the Albania Palace Hotel by another VPL agent, an elderly gent in a bowler whose matter-of-fact, undertakerish aspect might irritate Mr. Van Veen less, thought modest and sensitive Jim, than that of a Romanesque private detective. A sixth came by natural means to Park Lane. The lot, minus the last, which dealt exclusively with Ada's stage and screen ventures, is given below. Ada ignored dates, but they can be approximately determined. Los Angeles, early September, 1888. You must pardon me for using such a posh and also poshly means of having a letter reach you, but I'm unable to find any safer service. When I said I could not speak and would write, I meant I could not utter the proper words at short notice. I implore you. I felt that I could not produce them and arrange them orally in the necessary order. I implore you. I felt that one wrong or misplaced word would be fatal. You would simply turn away, as you did, and walk off again, and again, and again. I implore you for breath. Sick. Editor. Of understanding. But now I think that I should have taken the risk of speaking, of stammering, for I see now that it is just as dreadfully hard to put my heart and honor in script, even more so because in speaking one can use a stutter as a shutter, and plead a chance of slurring of words like a bleeding hare with one side of its mouth shot off, or twist back and improve. But against a background of snow, even the blue snow of this notepaper, the blunders are red and final. I implore you. One thing should be established once for all, indefeasibly. I loved, love, and shall love only you. I implore you and love you with everlasting pain and passion, my darling. Tit tut stoyal. You stayed here, in this caravansary. You in the middle of everything, always, when I must have been 7 or 8, didn't you? Los Angeles, mid-September, 1888. This is a second howl, Is Ada, out of Hades. Strangely, I learned on the same day from 3 different sources of your duel in K, of P's death, and of your recuperating at his cousin's. Kong's, as she and I used to say. I rang her up, but she said that you had left for Paris and that R had also died. Not through your intervention, as I had thought for a moment, but through that of his wife. Neither he nor P was technically my lover, but both are on Terra now, so it does not matter. Los Angeles, 1889. We are still at the candy pink and pisang green albergo where you once stayed with your father. He is awfully nice to me, by the way. I enjoy going places with him. He and I have gamed at Nevada, my rhyme-name town, but you are also there, as well as the legendary river of old Russia, Da. Oh, write me one tiny note. I'm trying so hard to please you. Want some more desperate little topics? Marina's new director of artistic conscience defines infinity as the farthest point from the camera which is still in fair focus. She has been cast as the deaf nun, Varvara, who in some ways is the most interesting of Chekhov's 4 sisters. She sticks to Stan's principle of having lore and role overflow into everyday life, insists on keeping it up at the hotel restaurant, drinks tea, vprikusku, biting sugar between sips, and feigns to misunderstand every question in Varvara's quaint way of feigning stupidity, a double imbroglio which annoys strangers but which somehow makes me feel I'm her daughter much more distinctly than in the Artis era. She's a great hit here on the whole. They gave her, not quite gratis, I'm afraid, a special bungalow, labeled Marina Dormanova in Universal City. As for me, I'm only an incidental waitress in a fourth-rate Western, hip-swinging between table-slapping drunks. But I rather enjoy the Hussay atmosphere, the dutiful art, the winding hill roads, the reconstructions of streets, and the obligatory square, and a mauve shop sign on an ornate wooden facade. And around noon, all the extras in period togs queuing before a glass booth. But I have nobody to call. Speaking of calls, I saw a truly marvelous ornithological film the other night with Damon. I had never grasped the fact that the paleotropical sunbirds, look them up, are mimetypes of the New World hummingbirds. And all my thoughts, oh my darling, are mimetypes of yours. I know. I know. I even know that you stopped reading it grasped, as in the old days. California, 1890. I love only you. I'm happy only in dreams of you. You are my joy and my world. This is as certain and real as being aware of one's being alive, but, oh, I don't accuse you. But, Van, you are responsible. Or fate through you is responsible, sicca revio mem, for having let loose something mad in me when we were only children. A physical hankering, an insatiable itch. The fire you rubbed left its brand on the most vulnerable, most vicious and tender point of my body. Now I have to pay for your rasping the red rash too strongly, too soon, as charred wood has to pay for burning. When I remain without your caresses, I lose all control of my nerves. Nothing exists any more than the ecstasy of friction, the abiding effect of your sting, of your delicious poison. I do not accuse you, but this is why I crave and cannot resist the impact of alien flesh. This is why our joint past radiates ripples of boundless betrayals. All this you are free to diagnose as a case of advanced erotomania. But there is more to it, because there exists a simple cure for all my mow and throes, and that is an extract of scarlet eril, the flesh of you, just only you. Je réalise, as your sweet Cinderella de Torf, now Madame Trofim Fartikoff, used to say, that I'm being coy and obscene, but it all leads up to an important, important suggestion. Van, je suis sur la verge, blanche again, of a revolting, amorous adventure. I could be instantly saved by you. Take the fastest flying machine you can rent straight to El Paso. Your Ada will be waiting for you there, waving like mad, and will continue by the New World Express in a suite I'll obtain to the burning tip of Patagonia. Captain Grant's Horn, a villa in Verna, my jewel, my agony. Send me an aerogram with one Russian word, the end of my name, and wit. Arizona, summer, 1890. Mere pity. A Russian girl's zhlostya drew me to R, whom musical critics have now discovered. He knew he would die young and was always, in fact, mostly corpse, never once, I swear, rising to the occasion, even when I showed openly my compassionate non-resistance, because I, alas, was brimming with vanless vitality, and had even considered buying the services of some rude, the ruder the better, young mujik. As to P, I could explain my submitting to his kisses, first tender and plain, later growing fiercely expert, and finally tasting of me when he returned to my mouth. A vicious circle set spinning in early Thargelian, 1888, by saying that if I stopped seeing him, he would divulge my affair with my cousin to my mother. He did say he could produce witnesses, such as the sister of your Blanche and a stable boy who, I suspect, was impersonated by the youngest of the three demoiselles de Tourbe, witches all. But enough. Van, I could make much of those threats in explaining my conduct to you. I would not mention, naturally, that they were made in a bantering tone, hardly befitting a genuine blackmailer. Nor would I mention that even if he had proceeded to recruit anonymous messengers and informers, it might have ended in his wrecking his own reputation as soon as his motives and actions were exposed, as they were bound to be in the long ruin. Sick. Run in her blue stocking. Editor. I would conceal, in a word, that I knew the coarse banter was meant only to drill jar your poor brittle Ada, because, despite the coarseness, he had a keen sense of honor, odd though it may seem to you and me. Now, I would concentrate entirely on the effect of the threat upon one ready to submit to any infamy, rather than face the shadow of disclosure. For, and this, of course, neither he nor his informers could know, shocking as an affair between first cousins might have seemed to a law-abiding family, I refused to imagine, as you and I have always done, how Marina and Duman would have reacted in our case. By the jolts and skids of my syntax, you will see that I cannot logically explain my behavior. I do not deny that I experienced a strange weakness during the perilous assignations I granted him, as if his brutal desire kept fascinating not only my inquisitive senses, but also my reluctant intellect. I can swear, however, solemn Ada can swear that in the course of our sylvan trysts, I successfully evaded, if not pollution, at least possession, before and after your return to Ardis, except for one messy occasion when he half took me by force, the overeager dead man. I'm writing from Marina Ranch, not very far from the little gulch in which Aqua died, and to which I myself feel like creeping someday. For the time being, I'm returning for a while to the Pisang Hotel. I salute the good auditor. When Vaughn retrieved in 1940 this thin batch of five letters, each in its VPL pink silk paper case, from the safe in his Swiss bank, where they had been preserved for exactly one half of a century, he was baffled by their small number. The expansion of the past, the luxuriant growth of memory had magnified that number to at least 50. He recalled that he had also used as a cache the desk in his Park Lane studio, but he knew he had kept there only the innocent sixth letter, Dreams of Drama, of 1891, which had perished together with her coded notes of 1884 to 1888 when the irreplaceable little palazzo burnt down in 1919. Rumor attributed the bright deed to the city fathers, three bearded elders and a blue-eyed young mayor with a fabulous amount of front teeth, who could no longer endure their craving for the space that the solid dwarf occupied between two alabaster colossi. But instead of selling them the blackened area as expected, Vaughn gleefully erected there his famous Lucinda Villa, a miniature museum just two stories high, with a still-growing collection of micro-photographed paintings from all public and private galleries in the world, not excluding Tartary, on one floor, and a honeycomb of projection cells on the other. A most appetizing little memorial of Parian marble, administered by a considerable staff, guarded by three heavily armed stalwarts, and open to the public only on Mondays for a token fee of $1, regardless of age or condition. No doubt the singular multiplication of those letters in retrospect could be explained by each of them casting an excruciating shadow, similar to that of a lunar volcano, over several months of his life, and tapering to a point only when the no less pangful precognition of the next message began to dawn. But many years later, when working on his Texture of Time, Vaughn found in that phenomenon additional proof of real times being connected with the interval between events, not with their passage, not with their blending, not with their shading the gap wherein the pure and impenetrable texture of time transpires. He told himself he would be firm and suffer in silence. Self-esteem was satisfied. The dying duelist dies a happier man than his live foe ever will be. We must not blame Vaughn, however, for failing to persevere in his resolution, for it is not hard to understand why a seventh letter, transmitted to him by Adas and his half-sister at Kingston in 1892, could make him succumb. Because he knew it was the last in the series. Because it had come from the blood-red Érable arbors of Ardis. Because a sacramental four-year period equaled that of their first separation. Because Lucette turned out to be, against all reason and will, the impeccable paranymph.